We're going to open the Committee on Rules, and we have a little bit of housekeeping things we're going to do very quickly. So the first thing we're going to do is... we're going to open a work session for the introduction of committee measures. And again, just so people remember, these are bills which voting for them has no indication whether you support or not. These are only to be introduced, and I'd like to make that clear so everybody knows. And with that, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 1325, dated 1-29-09, LC 353, dated 6-9-08, LC 1085, dated 2-11-09, LC 189, dated 2-20-09, LC 189-1, dated 2-20-09, LC 1487, dated 12-30-08, LC 2882, dated 2-16-09.
Representative Edwards has moved that LC 1325, LC 353, LC 1085, LC 189, LC 189-1, that's interesting, LC 1487 and LC 2882 be introduced as committee bills. Do I see any discussion? Yes. Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, just I know you made the formal announcement, but I'm invoking my disclaimer.
And I assume that everyone has invoked their disclaimer.
Absolutely.
Yes,
that.
Mr. Chair. My motion in no way indicates any formal support for any of these measures that I have not read yet.
So with that, any opposition? So ordered they will be. We will close our work session. And we're going to open a very quick work session, because we have one representative that needs to get going. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2386. This is the bill we heard before on voter registration, electronic voter registration, and so I will have some invited testimony to our work session. We have an amendment, and we just wanted to make sure that people knew what that amendment was. You should have a copy of that amendment.
Okay, I'm looking for my...
The committee, State Representative Ben Cannon, House District 46 in Portland. Not here to give any prepared testimony, but instead to answer questions about the Dash 1 amendment or any aspect of this bill. As you recall, this bill directs the Secretary of State to create a system for online voter registration, not online voting. I want to be very clear again about that. We've worked with very closely with the Secretary of State's office. They've been extraordinarily helpful in finding a way to make this work, as has the Department of Transportation and Division of Motor Vehicles. The amendment in front of you, the Dash 1 amendment, does bring forward by 1 year the implementation date, and that works well for the Secretary of State's office. It also clarifies that the Department of Transportation shall provide a digital copy of the driver's license holder or the registered voter's signature for the purposes of their online registration. So this was, in a sense, a technical amendment to help the bill achieve what we intended for it to achieve when we introduced it.
Any questions? Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cannon, do you have any reservations at all about security on Social Security numbers and that type of information being made available?
I think, Chair Roblin, Representative Gerard, I think any time we're talking about an online system, it's worth asking the question about security and being very comfortable as legislators and sort of stewards of the public's trust in our voting system that we have properly safeguarded the system. I'm going to defer to our experts who can talk a little bit more about how the system would actually work and the steps it would take to provide for the kind of security that that it needs to have.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, if I may, I wanted to introduce Dave Franks. He's our HAVA director for Oregon, and I know that there were a couple of technical questions that folks wanted to ask around security and what how the process is going to work, and so if we could take a couple of minutes to ask those questions so we can have them in the record, that would be something we're here to do.
Okay. Proceed.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, Representative Gerard, for the record, my name is Dave Franks. I'm the Help America Vote Act and Centralized Voter Registration Manager for the Secretary of State's office. Representative Gerard, specific to Social Security numbers, those won't be included in this system. Like Washington, we will require that the registrant have an Oregon driver's license number, and we will ask them to submit that as part of the application process. We will use the standard security issues that are out there for the internet on this piece. This piece will not directly tie into the current centralized voter registration system. It will be a standalone system that's separate, and then at a regular basis we'll have one-way communication with the centralized voter registration system to add the registrants into a queue for the counties to review before they accept the registration.
Thank you. Other questions of our witnesses? Okay. I guess you got the answers. That was pretty exciting. Committee, we're going to close this work session, and we'll open another one. Eventually, we will, I anticipate, working this bill. We don't have the required fiscal yet, so especially with the amendment, and I anticipate at the end of the meeting today we'll open up the meeting and add the amendment so we have it done, and then that will force the issue to get the fiscal. But I want to get the other deal going. We could actually we'll do that. So I'm going to close this work session on House Bill 2386. Thank you both all for being here.
It's actually a public hearing and work session. Do you want to open the session?
I'm going to pass the gavel to my vice chair, and do you have an agenda for him?
I probably have one.
Agenda?
Oh, here we go.
Just give him the script.
Give him the script if you want it.
We did. So then you want to do 2440, then, and then 2500, 2500.
This is 2500 right now.
Okay.
Go to 2500. Yep.
Okay. Open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2500.
What bill?
Yes.
2500.
Thank you. Acting Chair Edwards. HB 2500 requires the Director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to establish a single searchable website listing total expenditures and revenue for each state agency and additional detailed information on certain expenditures and sources of revenue. The website must also list any audit reports issued by the Secretary of State for each state agency and salaries and total compensation for all elected officials in the Executive Department and the Legislative Department. It requires each state agency to provide to the Director all data required for the website within 30 days after the data becomes available. Specifies that each state agency must maintain a publicly accessible transaction register of all expenditures over $100 and provide the Department of Administrative Services with a link to that transaction register. Identifies information required to be maintained on the register. Provides an exception for salaries, wages, compensation, and information that could be used to identify individual employees. Further requires the Department of Administrative Services to maintain a link to each state agency transaction register from the website and directs the Department of Administrative Services to annually post on the website the total number of full-time employees for each state agency, the average compensation by class, and actual compensation for positions receiving compensation of more than $50,000 per year. States across the country and even the federal government are creating searchable internet sites that allow people to see detailed records of how their tax dollars are spent. Proponents of searchable internet sites containing government expenditures assert that taxpayers deserve to know how their money is used and that access to such information increases the transparency and accountability of government. According to proponents, 13 states have launched such websites since 2007 through legislative or gubernatorial action. Additional websites have been created by other state constitutional officers in 10 states. Website legislation is also passed in other states but not yet been implemented. It appears that Virginia may have become the latest state to pass such legislation. According to one internet-based news account that I reviewed today, separate but mirrored budget transparency bills passed the Virginia Senate and Virginia House of Delegates on February 25th, 2009, by unanimous votes. Significant differences do exist in terms of the kinds of information available on the different websites. That is my summary.
Thank you. I see we have a number of you here to testify. I'll defer to the chair who didn't make it very far. I thought you were leaving the room. And want to kick us off?
Thank you, Chair Edwards and committee. I sit here before you very pleased with the beginnings of what I hope will continue to grow in Oregon with regard to the transparency of our government. I began 25 years ago working with a group of students for Youth in Government, and if you were here last week, you saw those students around the building understanding what it's like to be... Oh, I better say this. I'm Representative Arnie Roblin, for the record.
This is my committee.
Since it's, yeah, this is the committee. House District...
I apologize for not catching that. Rookie mistake.
It's okay. I got people up here to help me. The Youth in Government program is a really remarkable opportunity for kids from all over our state to come here and find out what it's like to be a representative. And before they get here, they have written bills and done a lot of work. And one of the things that has always been interesting is that you start teaching these students how to find information to write their bills and how to find information about the cost and all of those things. And what you find is they can find lots of information about writing bills and doing bills. It's difficult for them to figure out the financial deal, how much their bill is going to cost, what would be other costs. And when you look in the government stuff, it's difficult to find. You can ask for information and you will get it. It's public information. But the problem is there's no one place to go and find that kind of information. What this bill, what the vision of this bill is, and as we work on it, we're going to talk to you, that we recognize that this is the vision we want for our state at some point, to have this one database where it's searchable and you can find all this information. We recognize in our current state with respect to the economy that that's going to be difficult to do, and we have some other exciting opportunities probably to keep working on that. But we've been working with DAS. They've been very, very supportive of finding out what could we put up right now. As you know, with this budget issue we're doing right now, we are putting stuff up currently because we believe in this, about what's happening with our budget right now so people can get access to it. And I think this bill is basically saying, wouldn't it have been nice if we had the structure already in place, a place where people could go and find out this information? I think all of us would agree that would have been a wonderful thing. We have work to do, and what you're going to hear from all of us today is that our goal is to start that process and make this the most accessible state in the nation. It was interesting when we were doing some research for this, there was a great quote from Senator Wayne Morris from Oregon, and I appreciated that. When I came here, he was the senator in Oregon. And his comment, and I'll paraphrase, was that you have to have faith in the citizens of Oregon. And if they had the information, which they don't have accessible to them, they would help us make the best decisions we can. And I agree with that statement. I do believe that if the citizens of Oregon had more information, they would help us. Currently, they send us lots of information when they agree or disagree with us, but it would be helpful for them as they look and maybe help our state become more efficient in different places. They could understand, wow, the government and that particular agency is doing a great job with the money they have, and I'm impressed with all the things they get done. I think that not having it doesn't give them the real understanding of how well our government does work and how careful they are with the dollars. And in those places where we can improve, they can help us improve. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague to the right. Oh, I guess you are to the middle.
Depends on your... Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jefferson Smith, State Representative, District 47. I want to thank Representative Roblin and Representatives Wisnett and Thatcher for putting a shoulder to this wheel. I also want to take just a half a moment to thank the staff members who worked really hard putting this together, Don Phillips to my right and in more ways than one, perhaps, and Quinn Riley, who is seated behind me. But for these folks, I would be, you know, probably more just an emptier suit. We will all, over the next several months, be having significant discussions about which there will be significant disagreements about how to deal with the current economic challenges. And I say that probably without enough significance. And we will disagree on lots of things about where we should raise revenues and where we should cut services or where we can find efficiencies and creative solutions. What hopefully we can agree upon about, and where hopefully we can find little disagreement, one of the best things we can do is the importance, recognizing the importance of offering folks more information about what we are doing and decisions we are making. This committee, in multiple respects, and I happen to know this as people personally, are interested in outcomes-driven government. And so I will offer just one piece of outcome. Oregon Progress Board, who I think will testify today, will give a little more information than I, tested folks on whether they could identify the number one source of expenditures and the number one source of revenue for the state of Oregon. Not know the whole budget, but just know what's the biggest pieces. And only 12%, they were hoping they could get to half. Only 12% of citizens in Oregon could identify the number one place we spend money, which is education, number in the general fund, the number one place from where we get money. In fact, in that second category, the biggest group thought that it wasn't either where we spent money, it wasn't either public safety or education or human services. They thought other services in the general fund was bigger than those other three things. So to amplify Chair Robles, Representative Robles' comments, there is more that we can do, including making sure we address government contracts, making sure we send out voters quick information, both about government spending and about the services offered. I'm hoping this will be the first step in a movement around making people and helping people get more connected to what we're doing as a government. There are a couple other proposals we'll be putting forward soon, and hopefully we will again build a movement in the direction of greater awareness and participation. The critiques we will hear, if we hear any, will group either around, essentially, we don't want people to know, or we don't have the ability, the money, to get it done. My hunch is the people who don't want people to know will only say, we don't have the money to get it done. So I want to address that quickly. The federal government had a plan, I believe it was to put up all $2 trillion worth of spending, and they thought it was going to cost them $20 million. It turned out that to do all of what they did, it cost them $1 million. Oklahoma's transparency website, they did with $40,000 from their existing budget. Nebraska spent $38,000 for their first two phases. Missouri did it for zero additional dollars in appropriations within already existing staff and appropriations. Not only will it not cost much if we do it right, and we have cooperation from key agency people to help us do it right and start it off by doing it cheaply, but it'll also be worth it. In Texas, which is not perhaps a model for all things, they found $2.3 million in countable savings directly linked to doing this, and a variety of cost savings and efficiencies. In the meetings we have had with the Department of Administrative Services, they're committed to figuring out what can be done within our existing structure, what can be done within current budget constraints. And as I wrap, let me just say a couple of things. First, this is not a new idea. To quote Thomas Jefferson in his words to Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin in 1802, we might hope to see the finances of the Union as clear and as intelligible as the merchant's books, so that every member of Congress and so that every person of any mind should be able to comprehend them and to investigate abuses and consequently to control them. They didn't have websites then, but they had the will. We now have the way. Oregon should set an example to the nation in terms of governmental excellence as an innovator in increasing participation in government. That's why I applaud this committee in its efforts on online registration and why I applaud our efforts here. However we feel about a variety of issues, we should agree that government should seek excellence and that this century should see a dawn of greater participation, awareness in our shared government, and a movement not just left or right, but forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Moving down to Representative Thatcher.
Hi, I'm Kim Thatcher. I represent Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh, District 25. And he said a lot of things that I won't repeat, but I said, well, I guess some of them bear repeating, but I did serve on the Government Accountability and Information Technology Committee for the past few years, and This is where those two ideas, government accountability and information technology, get married. And this will produce a good thing for the state of Oregon. And as was pointed out, this is not a partisan issue. Transparency is not a partisan issue. It's prudent public policy. And this whole concept seemed like a no-brainer to most folks out there, because most families and businesses out there have to watch the bottom line, watch, carefully monitor their expenditures, and as well as what's coming in, to make sure that they're being responsible. And I hear from citizens all the time who say that it's hard to figure out the budget. That information is not readily accessible, though they can see reports in the press, because apparently they own the PhDs and secret decoder rings that allow them to be able to get through the mess that is our budget. But they want to know the real dollar figures, and they want to do some investigation themselves. And this particular bill would allow that. Last year, there was a national study, and it showed that a third of all Americans search the web for information on government taxes and spending, but most come away disappointed in the lack of good, easily understandable information. And there was a study conducted on behalf of the Coalition for an Accountable Recovery. This is discussing the federal stimulus package. And on the top of most Americans' agenda for the new administration are greater accountability and openness in government. And it found that roughly 8 in 10 say that making the U.S. government more accountable and more open to average citizens are an important priority, and that carries through to the state level as well. A similar number of Americans believe it would be important to create state websites for the same purpose. And regardless of how one feels about the federal stimulus package, there's a good thing that I will point out, and that is that there could be funding from the federal government for this very operation, because they do want that accountability for the spending on the stimulus bill. I'm not going to repeat anything else, but just say that sunshine is the best disinfectant, and leave it at that. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and honorable committee members. Good bill should pass. Nah, you're not going to get away with that. This morning, we had a little meeting, and I didn't get to give my Jefferson quote. I have another Jefferson quote. We might hope to see the finances of the union as clear and intelligible as... that's the one you did.
It's a pretty good quote. You'll find there's bipartisan approval for the use of the quote.
Mr. Chair and committee members, in 2006, Congress passed and President Bush signed into law the Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act. It was co-sponsored by Senator Tom Coburn, Republican Oklahoma, and Barack Obama, Democrat Illinois. To strengthen the 2006 law, legislation was introduced by the initial co-sponsors and John McCain and Tom Capper in June 3rd, 2008. Representative Thatcher talked about the federal stimulus and how we're going to have to report that. The leaders of our body have said that we're going to report on our stimulus package of how the money was spent and how many jobs it's created. This is the opportunity. This is a good bill. We know it needs some work, and we know that we can't go all the way to the top this session, but I would appreciate this committee's support and help in allowing us to go back and seek some amendments that we can actually accomplish this session and provide the transparency that the people of Oregon deserve. And it's also going to help state agencies, we found out from other examples. So, again, good bill should pass.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. Representative Wisnett, the Jefferson you were referring to is not the one on your right.
Would that were true.
Learned some, Mr. Chair and Representative Garrard, we've learned a lot of good things about Jefferson Smith, who was named after, and his brother was named, we've learned today, was also named after President Lincoln.
I don't care who answers the second one
or really that previous topic, perhaps.
This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. What do you see as the cost of this program?
Go ahead.
I think the
the effort working with DAS, and I'll turn it over to Representative Roble and anybody else, but I think our objective right now is to work with DAS to approach zero and to see what can be done given current staffing levels. We already put a lot of stuff on the web, but it's in a lot of different websites that you need to, I mean, I don't know them yet, and I've been here for several weeks, and much less, you know, folks who've never been here at all. So the hope is that we'll get it down towards zero. The other thing I would say is if there's something relatively manageable and small, my hope is that we would decide it's worth it for two reasons. One, because it will, and when I say approach zero, hopefully it's 100 grand or less, you know, or zero. The two reasons that I think it'd be worth it if it is a non-zero. First, hopefully we'll save the money. It'll pay for itself relatively quickly. And second, we're going to be making some very, 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 very hard choices, both on the revenue side and on the cutting side, I assume. And giving people at the same time and a commitment to additional transparency, I think, is exactly the message we need to send as we're making those hard choices.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'll just add a little bit to that. Representative Jensen, I just before the meeting, he was reading it over, and he was saying, we're expecting DAS to do all of this. And when I was first doing that and I first had my first conversation with DAS, they came to explain some of the concerns that they had, how many different programs we have out there doing this, and how the fact that this bill would expect all of them to be searchable between each other. That's a difficult task. And if you were to say, how much money today do I just put in to fix the whole thing, it would be rather large. But once we all had the same understanding that that was the goal, was to get more transparency and to start building it out, a lot of people, and the DAS people in particular, have been very excited about working with us. We've also met with the state treasurer, who wants us to realize that DAS is in a different group than they are. The legislative branch is a different group than DAS is. Each of those we will be working with to find out what we can get to the table to make this happen. And so there are some things we have to work. Our goal is exactly as Jefferson has described, to get down to negligible initial money at this time, but a lot more transparency and at least some ways of linking, so if you're in one place, you know where you can go look at the other place and find the answers.
Mr. Chair, may I comment?
Absolutely.
Thank you. We've done a lot of research in this, and there's a lot of good examples. You can go, we'll give you some states that haven't, you can go search them. But, you know, Oregon, again, we're ahead of a lot of it in that we have half of our budget, the education budget for your K-12 is already online. And we just need a way to put that into the system, the chalkboard open books project and the ODE. So there's a lot of things out there, and once we put the stimulus package, so again, I think that it's really possible and doable this session to do some forward part of the project, maybe not all of it.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that with these four particular co-sponsors, that this would be a bill that would have a really good chance of, and well, it should, but after my experience with Marion Barry's, nothing is in this process. So let me put something on the record here. When I came into this session, I decided to go paperless, and it has opened my eyes to the web in ways that I have never before viewed it. And I understand when a person who is younger than I am, like Representative Smith, talks about his generation being just plain web-based, I'm beginning to get a clue of the long-term implications of that. This bill seems like a no-brainer to me. Why didn't you tell me to do it last session when we had a little more money? and I just think that it would help me in thousands of ways, just linking to this when I answer emails from constituents and saying, you have questions about, you know, your revenue, and I would put it on every constituent email that calls and asks about government services. You'd put a link on there. Now that I'm so internet savvy, I see the possibilities. And so I hope you can go forward. I hope we can find funding. As you say, there's a lot of bits and pieces of this all the way out there, already out there. But if it isn't searchable, if it isn't understandable, if people who are sort of internet novice as I am can't can't manipulate it, then we're just causing more bureaucracy and not more clarity. But I love this idea, and I wish you great good luck. Just because it's a good idea doesn't mean it gets... Thank you.
And I can concur, Representative. It would have been nice to have passed this bill last session when revenue was up, but I would argue, as have many of my colleagues so articulately already, that if we want to prioritize this, we can prioritize this. Now, I'm not going to pretend that it won't come at an expense elsewhere, but this body is charged with prioritizing how we spend money, how we raise money, and how transparent that process is and is going to be. And so if we want to do that, we certainly can do that, and it will mean making another cut somewhere among the scores and scores of cuts that we're already making, and perhaps this is just the time to do it because the people want to see accountability for the cuts we're making, for revenue that might be raised, and for how we're prioritizing. And I can only imagine how much staff time would be saved throughout the agencies if we could take our constituent requests and direct them to a website, because I know that agencies spend a lot of time processing requests from my constituents. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm not sure who might want to respond to this. I certainly think that it helps everybody, those of us who have to make decisions, those of us who craft the decisions, and the constituents that we represent, if people understand what services and what services are delivered and how we deliver those services through state agencies, through our partners at local governments. But it seems to me that there is a strong emphasis in this around compensation, which is something I think people understand. People recognize what those numbers are, but I'm not sure out of context of the service that it is as helpful to them as it could be. For example, I don't know that it helps me understand the quality of the service I get at my auto mechanics if I know how much each of those people is paid. And frankly, as a customer, I'm not sure I care, as long as my car is properly repaired, it's done on time, and I can rely on them if I need to come back if something doesn't work. So I'm trying to understand how it helps anyone understand the value of the health services that the state provides, or the public safety services that the state provides, or the education services that are provided either through the state or our partners, to know the salary of someone who makes $51,000 a year.
And I would contend that that's a fairly small part of this bill. I think, okay, it is one of the things that a lot of people ask about. And the other thing I would say is, if you look at open books, it kind of gives you general ideas of how much teachers and whatever cost. And what happened when open books happened, was presented, people started realizing that, oh, wow, I thought they got a lot more than that, or they didn't. And then they got to, well, wow, those other districts, they all pay about the same. I mean, all of a sudden what they thought was a problem went away, because the information was open and available. And I think that all of those things add to the knowledge, but I think the bigger part of it is that a whole lot more of the website should be some of the graphs and things you're seeing here that show how those things are chopped up and all those other things. And I think people ask that question, constituents ask that question about how much do people make. And I think that's why it's listed there as one of the items that have to be addressed. But I don't see it as a big part of this bill. I mean, I see it as one part of the whole. If others want to answer that, they should.
Representative Thacker. Yeah, I just want to make a comment, Mr. Chair and Representative Nolan, that I think it shouldn't be identifying a person. And I agree with what you said, that it's, you know, what am I paying overall for my car to get fixed? I don't care what my mechanic's getting paid. But in state government, a lot of people are curious about, well, say the state police. The state police have a pay parity issue with other organizations, and it might be interesting to know that the state police don't get what the Portland police do. Or, you know, if this website should catch on at the local level, I would hope it will, and I hope that we set the example. But I think it's just important for people to know a generalization, and I think that's how it's stated. It does not try to identify individuals. It's just an overall statement of hourly salary.
I'd say three things.
I have a follow-up.
In response to Representative Nolan, three things. First, it is important to at least one of us that in addition to, and really importantly, that we are doing our best to link outcomes to costs, right? One could imagine, either in this world or a mythical world, where there might be some group of people who wanted to use information like this to attack government. And we might imagine there's another group of people in a mythical world that wanted to use this information to trumpet the benefits of government. And the hope is that we would provide enough information where the conversation would merge to a point where it was a little bit of both and a little bit less of either. A second thing I'd say is that I think we are given the economic crisis and the budget challenges actually give us a window of opportunity for cooperation that might be different if we were swimming in a sea of money. That I think all of us are very open to a host of ideas from agencies, legislators, members of this committee in terms of what things we should prioritize and what things are available. And that includes, you know, for sure you, if there are things, what would make it better, et cetera, very open. And the third thing I would say, just to amplify Representative Roblin's point, is that the decision-making that happens, and I think that whether we think this is more like a law firm where I know the hourly rate that I pay my lawyer, or an auto mechanic where I only know sort of and I don't know their annual compensation, whether either of those is the standard, if there's a different standard in democracy, and I guess I could argue both ways. My hope is whether we're citing Brandeis and saying that sunlight is the best disinfectant. Overall, I think, yeah, the more people learn, the more they'll realize they're getting a decent deal, and that teachers aren't overpaid, and that legislators don't make very much at all, and that sharing this information will make people fear less because people fear more what they don't know and what they don't understand.
Yeah. I might follow up. Clearly, we operate in a world of public access to the information of every decision we make, and I'm not at all. I'm a proponent of that kind of availability. But websites can highlight aspects of information in a way that I think does direct attention one way or the other. And it is difficult, if not impossible, to construct them in a way that is without values. So I think we need to have the conversation that you alluded to, Representative, about what the purpose of this is, not just to inform, but to help people become aware of the values and the value and the outcome that they're getting from their government.
You get no argument from us on that.
Any other, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisner?
Real brief, Representative Nolan, when Representative Smith came into our group to work on this, he immediately said we want to be having a look at outcomes, and I think we want to do that. I think we even talked about that, or it was in the first bill, but in our ways and means process, as many on this committee know, we have our key performance measures, and that should be part of this data, too.
Thank you very much. And before the panel dismisses themselves, I think it should be noted for anybody in TV land that doesn't know the individuals sitting at the panel, we have two Republicans and two Democrats side by side pushing this bill. So thank you very much. We're going to go down the list. I believe we have a senator that may be here to testify. No. Okay. Then I will move down the list, and first we have Ruth. Ruth.
Sharon Coyne.
Okay. And Sharon.
Information and.
We have a list of the waiting room.
This is another aspect of transparency.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ruth Bendel. I'm the Voter Integrity Chair for the Republican Party, and my colleague Sharon Cornish has been very helpful. I've got testimony to pass around. When you talk about transparency, I also regard it important when it comes to the workings at the elections office during election time. I have many volunteers around the state who take the time to observe at the elections offices, and I've seen the deterioration of access to visibility of what is going on over the years. Sharon and I have been doing this for a number of years. When it comes to verifying the signatures on the outer envelope of the ballot, we're stuck in the middle of a room and can't see a thing. Can see the signature on the screen, but not what's on the ballot envelope. That's number one. Number two, we're opening ballots 7 days before the election, and people that we don't know, whose backgrounds we don't know, are sitting at a table because we are a voter intent state. That means they're determining amongst themselves what's the intent of a voter who's not been very clear. And they are actually adjusting according to the views of the people at the table how that person intended to vote. Yes.
I was just going to say, this bill is entirely about transparency of the electronic system for the budget here at the Capitol. And we will have other bills that talk about those issues. So, I, you know, if you can, keep your testimony to this transparency bill with regard to electronic transparency of the budget system, if you can.
So nothing to do with elections process?
This bill has nothing to do with the elections process.
Well, I'm sorry to bother
you. No problem.
But we will.
We are going to have a couple of them that do. So I do want to make sure that you have the opportunity to speak to those, and I guarantee that will happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Absolutely.
My name is Sharon Cornish, and I back up what she says. A lot of money came with the HAVA Act to the Secretary of State. Would that apply to transparency here?
It has to do with a different bill that we'll be listening to. There's two of them that we have later today that we're going to deal with. One has to do with military voting, and the other one has to do with the bill that we opened just for a short period of time earlier that had to do with the online registration. Those two would be more likely to deal with this issue.
I've got testimony for those.
Thank you.
Okay.
So next we'll have Rita Conrad, Jody Weiser, and David Rosenfeld. I think all of them can come if they would like. We have three still up there. Yep. I guess there's four chairs. So if Steve wants to come up, he could as well. It would be Steve Buckstein. Steve? So, with that, we'll start with Rita.
Yes, my name is co-chairs and members of the committee. I am Rita Conrad, Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board. There are two pieces of paper coming around. One is for people that take in information better with words. One is for people who take in information better with pictures. So, Mike, is that coming around? Representative Smith requested a short presentation on Oregon Benchmark Number 33, which he mentioned earlier, which measures whether Oregonians have a basic understanding of their tax system. Oregon benchmarks are 91 yardsticks, measuring Oregon's economic, social, and environmental well-being, and you can easily find these benchmarks at benchmarks.oregon.gov. No www needed. The benchmarks measure progress toward the goals in our statewide plan called Oregon Shines. The biennial Oregon population survey coordinated by the Progress Board since 1990 includes the two following questions. What do you think is the biggest source of revenue for state government? and the biggest portion of Oregon's general fund spending. Both questions are multiple choice. You'll see that in the picture version that you get. The assumption is that if an Oregonian can answer both questions correctly, then he or she will have a basic understanding of the state's tax system. Last summer, which was the last time we conducted the survey, it happens every 2 years, about 3,800 people answered both questions. Here's what we found on the revenue question. As Representative Smith said, the biggest portion, 38.5%, correctly answered personal income tax, which of course is over 80% of general fund revenue. Almost as many, nearly a third of all respondents, thought the biggest source of state revenue was property tax. 16% thought the biggest source of state revenue came from the lottery, and 10% thought it came from corporate income tax. For the expenditure question, here we found that 26.5% correctly answered education, which of course is more than 50% of general fund expenditures. Nearly an equal amount thought the biggest expenditure was for human services. The greatest portion of respondents, 35%, attributed the greatest general fund expenditure to the rather nondescript other category, and about 12% thought the greatest expenditure was public safety. Only 12.3% of respondents correctly answered both questions, and this is the number that we use for benchmark number 3, understanding of the tax system. Since 2002, the percentage of the population that can correctly answer both questions declined and trended away from the 2010 target of 50%. Last summer, it fell down to 12.3%, down from 16.8% in 2002, and it's been a steady decline since then. We conclude from this that as of last summer, 88% of Oregonians do not have a basic understanding of their tax system. That concludes the major portion of my testimony. Thank you.
Any questions, Representative Edwards?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we get a copy, or I would like a copy, of what of your testimony? I don't know if it's been...
That looks like it's...
Okay.
So that's never the word mind. Version. There's also
I
a picture
those
version.
Stats, so thank you.
Another question? We'll go on then.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Sorry to be so slow.
No problem.
Ms. Conrad, do you have any idea how other states fare?
No, I don't.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank Rita for coming, and this is an interesting way to take Oregon benchmark data and apply it to the work that we're doing, and this is very interesting statistics, and many of these are available on the Oregon Progress Board website, and as a board member of the Oregon Progress Board, I felt it my responsibility to say so.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Other questions? We'll move on then. Thank you. So, Joey.
My name is Jody Weiser, and I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon. My comments will be fairly short, and some of them very specific. I think this bill, 2500, really does move in the right direction. I think it's imperative that we give people access to understanding, like Rita was talking about, of where their money comes from and goes. And in fact, I went over to the Department of Revenue yesterday to pick up these two graphs because I had seen them when I was there one day and thought, wow, that's the most clear picture of where money comes from and where it goes that I've seen, the property tax and the income tax pages. And I think it was probably up on the slide earlier, or some other states doing the same thing. I picked up a copy of the tax booklet for the year, and that information is nowhere in there. And I thought, wow, instead of a lighthouse on the front of the income tax thing, wouldn't it be nice if we had how that money is going to be spent that's being paid? And it's kind of an educational piece that I think could happen there and should certainly be happening on the website as well. I would think that this would be a good opening. If you go to the website, how does Oregon spend its money, then you could start clicking on to the pieces and start understanding the underlying layers of those pieces and how they work. It was interesting that, you know, I was pretty sure that this would be someplace on the Department of Revenue's website. And I looked for it before I went over. And it does show how
how unsearchable websites sometimes are. It took 5 minutes for somebody at the department to find it, and that's because it's no longer in that view. It looks more like this. And so we were kind of just glancing through looking for the dollar bill, and we weren't paying attention to the pie graph when it came up. So I think that the site should really work on transparency that's kind of general about how we spend the money that we get, not just specifics of how we spend the money. And I also think that we should include not just how departments spend money, but how the legislature spends money when it makes choices about tax credits and other tax expenditures. So you could see not just how did the dollars go when they were supporting human services or public education? And I think it is important for people, if they want to know, wow, that special ed kid really did cost 5 times more than a regular kid or whatever. But we also need to know where everything else, all the other money goes that doesn't come in. And I don't see that addressed in this bill, and I'd like to see it added. I also think that if we're requiring transparency of government, and I think we should also ask for more transparency of business. That it would be a nice addition to this if we were looking at how much taxes came from people and how much taxes came from corporations, and was far more specific about which corporations pay $10 and which corporations pay significant amounts of money. And that's just another kind of transparency that we could be looking at. Now to the real specifics of, oh, and then the other piece in there is a piece of information that I knew had to be out there that I tried to get access to. I was just wondering, how much money are we spending on wind farms? And I asked Mike Graney in February 3 different times during the session, and he kept forgetting to he said, I'll get my fax to send it to you. I finally, you know, several weeks after the session, sent an email and got the information back. And yes, they do keep a list of how much money has been spent on various Betsy tax credits. But each time I want to update what are the new numbers, I have to send an email to Lou Torres, and he has to find it and send it to me. If we had a searchable website, I would know where to find it. I would just go there and look, and the Public Information Office wouldn't be needing to deal with me for me to get the information. I think it's a good example of the kind of way somebody might want to use the information. But to the really specific things, on page 2, line 20, it says that there should be a copy of any audit reports for any state agency. And I know a lot of times we actually do small pieces. We do, you know, we audited the Department of Revenue for its collection of 411 taxes. And that would not just, that wouldn't be an agency audit. It would be a little subsection. So you might want to add in more clarity that there would be any audit of any part of an agency or any program of an agency should be available. I think Section 3 is really that onerous section. If you spend more than $100, you're supposed to provide all of this information, including a detailed statement of the purpose of the expenditure. Well, I know for my own budget, I'd hate to have to say, what was the purpose of that hotel bill when I was in Phoenix last weekend? And it should be some kind of really detailed thing. I think that's a bit onerous. We probably don't need all of that. Just, you know, might be just name the program it's attached to or whatever. Or you might leave that section out entirely. I think that requires a lot of detail. And then on page 3, line 22, it asks for a list of all state agency full-time positions grouped by class. And my experience is that a lot of positions in our agencies are not full-time, and they speak of things in full-time and in full-time equivalents. And I think it's important that we value the fact that some people don't want to work full-time or don't get to work full-time, as the case may be. And we should, the data should be full-time or full-time equivalents. And there also might be information about whether those positions are filled or unfilled. I was looking at a department's list of positions for last June, so that was before this current crisis. There were 950 positions in that department, but there were 90 openings. That's a pretty high not-there rate, and I think that information would be
you know, you should say how many positions are filled rather than how many positions there are, or some disclosure of both if you're going to try to give that kind of information. So those are my comments to this bill. I also think that on the general information part, I think this document is my best source of information. And I have, you know, I've sent a lot of people to look at basic facts. But you wouldn't ever find it if someone didn't direct you to it, because if you're not involved with the legislature, you don't even know what the Legislative Revenue Office is. So you don't know to go to their place on the legislature's website, and then to go to publications, and then you find out that this is here. If this kind of information were on the website, somebody who is interested in beer taxes could Google beer taxes and find out where your beer taxes are like. I mean, there's two pages or so on beer taxes, and that would be a really good document to put on the searchable website. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. And our next witness.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I'm Dave Rosenfeld with Osberg. A couple points about all this. One, we will be, my timing is a little off, we will be releasing a report on Transparency 2.0 in general on Monday, which we will make sure to distribute to all the members of the committee to take a big look at all the ways with which Oregon, not just with this particular aspect of government spending, but the whole thing, how we could be moving forward and kind of taking that path out, number one. Number two, thing to remember, 19 states have essentially moved to what you would call Transparency 2.0. and the federal government. So what that means is, from a pure technology perspective, it's already been done. It could be, nothing is ever easy, I know, but to the extent that the software has already been developed, in a lot of cases that stuff is open source, especially the federal government's website, that's, we can easily, if we think about it that way, transfer a lot of that knowledge already that's there here and make that work here without having to reinvent the wheel. So we should just bear that in mind. Second thing. Third, just to add to some of the stats that Representative Smith was mentioning before about other states that have done this with existing resources, I was this morning on the phone with the woman who is the project director for the state of Missouri's website, which is probably one of the best ones out there, and she's not allowed to say how much it cost them, which makes a lot of sense because different states are different, but she said there was a total of 6,400.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I can't let the irony go by that we're talking about transparency and she's not allowed to tell us how much they spent on this project.
It is the show me state also, which is
true.
Pointed that out to her and she didn't have anything to say. They spent a total of 6,400 person hours to set their thing up. And that includes the contractors that they bought in, plus the in-house work. And so, again, you know, the rate per depends on the state. That's why she's not allowed to tell us an actual cost. But, you know, you can extrapolate that out, and you can see that that's not a huge amount of money that we're talking about. So, for what it's worth, that's another point. Then a couple of just kind of caveats as you're just working your way towards some kind of final piece of legislation. Recall that most of what's in here relates, not completely, but to an existing resource, which is the tax expenditure report that gets put out by the Department of Revenue. When I read the bill, you know, reading it through, it doesn't reference that at all. That may be deliberate, it may not be, but one thing we should just be sure to do, that the intent of this bill should be to, I would advise, to essentially enhance the existing thing that we do already with the tax expenditure report versus recreating something that, so then you got that thing over here and then this thing over here. It should essentially try to expand and enhance that, and then, of course, not take away from any of the things that the tax expenditure report already does. I myself have not looked so carefully to say this bill has everything that the tax expenditure report does, but as we kind of move the whole thing together, we should just be sure to sync all that up so what we come out with is one final product that's better than what we have already. So that's just one kind of technical point, but I think it's actually quite important because the TER is not a bad first step as far as it goes. Then two more points is I echo Jody's point that if it was one thing that you could do to make this bill stronger, it would be to expand one of the biggest deficiencies in the tax expenditure report, which said it doesn't cover, for lack of a better word, subsidies, tax subsidies. Now, it's not really a subsidy because what we're really talking about is who are all the companies and businesses that use tax credits and other economic development incentives that we've created many times for good reason. But you don't see that when you look at the tax expenditure report, and that's actually quite important to know, is who's taking these particular tax breaks that we've granted, and what was the purpose of that particular company taking that tax break? What was the actual economic outcome that happened as a result of that, and was it worth it? And if we could get that stuff up there, in addition to everything that's in the bill already, then you'd really have a very good picture of how we're spending our money, and also what are the outcomes, as you will, the context for why you'd be spending that. There's a bunch of states that include that in their transparency sites. The state of Illinois is probably one of the best ones. And so, anyways, I would just offer up, there's lots of good language out there for that. I'd offer up that that would be an important enhancement to the bill that wouldn't add too much extra once you're knowing the full mile anyways. Last point would just be that, remember that this is only one aspect of transparency. So there's obviously just what we spend. There's a whole ball of wax involved, which is contracting and how we're contracting out goods and services. There's another excellent bill, which is 2037, which will be heard in business and labor. So I just flag that to just kind of go that there's sort of a constellation of work that we need to do regarding transparency 2.0. This is one very, very important part of it, but contracting is another very important part of it. We should just keep that in mind as we go forward. And then I would just echo Representative Edwards' point that I don't believe this should cost any money. If it's going to cost a lot of money, then we've got a problem, I think, just if you look at the experience of the other states. But then I think this would be the perfect time for us to be moving towards this kind of transparency now that we're dealing with stimulus money, both here, state and federal. This would be exactly the right kind of message that we'd be sending to the voters, and so we're all for it.
Any questions for this witness? Okay.
Chair Rowland and members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit public policy research organization based in Portland. It was mentioned that there were two Republican and two Democrat major sponsors of the bill, which made it likely to pass. I'm not a member of either of those parties. I'm a member of another, so there's even more tripartisan, if you want to call it, support for this concept and for this bill. I just want to point out, as some of you know, it's not often that I come before any committee in the legislature and testify in favor of anything. I'm oftentimes more times testifying against what's going on in this building. And so, as Representative Jefferson Smith said earlier, it's really nice that people with differing political views, differing value systems on what's going on here can agree that the public, your constituents, deserve to see everything in an understandable form. There's lots of data out there on the web and on paper, but it doesn't mean much unless you can make sense of it in some kind of relatively easily understandable form. And as an example, I give something that happened in the election last year, and I won't mention the candidate. I don't want to embarrass anybody, but there was a candidate for statewide office, a major candidate for statewide office, who told the group, and I was sitting there, that the all funds budget of the state of Oregon was twice the general fund. Now, that was the case, that number, the $30 billion, he said the all funds budget was $30 billion last year. That was the number in the year 2000. The actual all funds budget in this biennium was about $48 billion, and this major candidate didn't know it, and I would argue that when you do polls and say, where are the major sources of income, what are the major expenditures in the state, that's just generally the general fund. And probably not one in ten Oregonians know that there's three times that much money that is being spent on their behalf in the state of Oregon. Now, that doesn't mean you control all of it and can make decisions in this session, but I think Oregonians deserve to know those higher level numbers, and I hope that this bill includes the all funds budget so that people can see all of the money that's being spent. Second of all, I won't spend time on how much this is going to cost. I think, again, Representative Smith and Dave here and others have talked about relatively minimal costs of this kind of a transparency bill in other states, and I think Oregon has the ability and the creativity to do it just as well and maybe even cheaper than other states, and there are ways, especially with like constituent questions, as has been mentioned by a couple members here, that could save you and your staffs a lot of time, that could save agency people a lot of time, information requests, et cetera, and could actually save the state money. So the minimal cost, I think, is not an argument for this. But the other thing, besides seeing the actual data, a math professor at Reed told me a few years ago, and I'll never forget this. I'm a policy analyst. I have a physics degree and an MBA, but I'd never thought about it in this simple term. He said, whenever I see two numbers, I have the irresistible urge to divide one into the other. And I've always remembered that, and it is so powerful. But the average person out there, when they see, even if they can see the all funds budget online on a website, $48 billion, or the general fund, say $15 billion, those are numbers that most of us can't put in context. What does it mean? What is $1 trillion at the federal level? You can't put it in context. But if you can divide it by the number of people in the state, by the number of state employees, by, for example, the spending in DHS, maybe the caseload per caseworker, or in schools, we always hear about the number of kids in a classroom. Those are numbers that people can comprehend. You know, 30 kids to a teacher, 15 hard cases to a caseworker, whatever the numbers are. I hope that this effort will divide one number into another, not just having the state or the agency make the decision of which two numbers to divide, but let the people out there, the citizens, your constituents, make those choices. And let the searchability include dividing whatever number they want into whatever other number they want. And I think you'll be surprised at how much more knowledgeable they are and maybe helpful, depending on your point of view on these sort of things. Finally, I and at least one other member, I think, on your committee here were members of the Governor's Revenue Restructuring Task Force, and we heard twice from Portland pollster Adam Davis, once at the beginning of the process back in, I think it was November of 2007, and once in January of this year, and his polling found that the citizens of Oregon have the lowest regard for both government, politics, and politicians that he'd seen in his 30-year history, in both polls, basically. The lowest regard, and they didn't separate government from politics. It was all one thing to them. And I think one thing that you all could do this legislative session, if you want to increase people's regard for you, trust in you, etc., is to pass this bill, HB 2500, and let them, again, divide numbers into others. Let them see everything. And some will take it and try to attack what you're doing. Some will take it and try and support what you're doing. But the knowledge will be so helpful to everybody that I think it will do maybe as much or more to raise the credibility of this body and government in general as anything you could do this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these people? No. Thank you very much for being here. Dugan Petty.
Chairman Roland, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill today. For the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I serve as the state's chief information officer, and I am the administrator of the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division of the Department of Administrative Services. You've heard
a little louder, if you can. Thanks.
Although my written testimony goes into what the bill does, you've already heard that and got a pretty good sense of that. We have spoken with the sponsors of the bill. We have taken a look at the bill. We've formed a team starting with the key divisions in the Department of Administrative Services that have this data for many of the agencies. For example, the Controller's Division, who's responsible for the statewide financial management system, many of the expenditure reports would come from their basic information. So we've got a team working with them, and we are looking at this bill to determine how much of this information requested in the bill is readily available today. And our tact is to determine of that information, how close does that get to what's requested in the bill? And then we want to come back to the sponsors and see, is this a good starting point? The bill, as it's currently written, will have some expense to implement. Not all the states who have implemented these bills are in the same position. Some of them have enterprise resource planning tools, for example, and what that means is they have financial management systems, human resource systems that are integrated, and it collects this information in a consistent way and allows you to search on that information and match information up. We don't have that kind of information available to us. We have different systems that collect information from different agencies and that this bill covers. And so for us to collect it all and put it into a database that would allow it to be what I call aggregated and searched, so as one of the prior testimonies is of the ability to divide numbers, we're just not in that position to do that right now. And that would be fairly expensive. So what we want to do is take a look at what information has been requested, how close can we get to that, and what could we put up on a transparency website today. My division is responsible for the e-government website, Oregon.gov, and we believe it would be fairly easy and within existing resources to create a transparency site that you would come to through Oregon.gov, bring up the transparency site. And so we're working with agencies to find out what information could be available at no expense, how close does that get, and can we link that and put that up on this site as a starting point. Some of the bill as it's currently written, Section 3, I believe, for example, has a $100 transaction register. A prior person has testified that might be a bit onerous. That is an area that is difficult. We have over 60 payment systems, I'm told, by the State Controllers Division that make payments, and that detail at $100 isn't readily available. But we do think that we can get reports off of the statewide financial management system that would, by agency, tell what the total expenditures are and what contractors or suppliers or who received the funding for that. And so our effort right now is to categorize that, inventory that, find out what form that's available, and then sit down with the sponsors and see how close we can get to this, to what they've asked for. So that's what we're doing right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And before that, I just want to say, I think, for all the sponsors on this. We have been exceedingly pleased with your response and receptiveness to working on this stuff and to start doing this. So I think you have all of us looking forward to working with you to do that. So I really do appreciate that. Other questions? Any questions, Dugan? Thank you very much. That takes care of all the people who had signed up for this bill. Is there anyone else who would like to testify at this time who did not get on the list? We will close our public hearing on House Bill 2500, and I thank all of you for being here.
They don't have the other thing on it anyway.
So which one is it? Is it 2511?
2511, because we have to send
Okay. You have to go to. Oh, does that give us enough?
No, we still have a quorum, don't we? Representative Reed and Representative Gelser left their stuff, so I presume that means they're coming back.
And also, this is a public hearing on this other one, so we don't need to have.
Yeah, it's just a public hearing.
That's right, we're okay. We already did it.
We did that right
there. Well, there's a problem there. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2511. With that, Representative Wisnett. First we'll have a short explanation by our administrator. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. House Bill 2511 directs the Secretary of State by rule to adopt an electronic voting system to allow long-term absentee electors to cast ballots electronically. It allows the Secretary of State to utilize U.S. Department of Defense voting assistance system for electronic transmission of election materials and requires the Secretary of State to adopt rules governing procedures for receiving ballots cast electronically. Proponents of electronic voting for long-term absentee electors assert that there is a need to make it easier for such electors to participate in U.S. elections. Opponents assert that electronic voting is not secure. That is my report.
Thank you very much. And with that, Representative Lisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and honorable members of this committee. Thank you very much. This is a bill that I bring to you today, House Bill 2511, which I have a great interest in. having served in the U.S. military for 27 years and casting many absentee ballots. I'm not going to read. I have a prepared testimony for you. The one thing I think is interesting in my bill is I'm not telling the Secretary of State how to do it. I'm not going into detail and talking about security. I'm just saying to the good people in the Secretary of State's office, do this. Make it happen for the people covered by the Uniform and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. There are 18,358 uniformed service members and estimated 14,000 family members. I didn't do Wisnet. This is Representative Gene Wisnet, District 53, Deschutes County. And I'm glad to speak on this bill. But there's a lot of people that this is affected. I have received a letter that Secretary, I have a copy of a letter the Secretary of State received from Scott Weidman, the Deputy Director of the Federal Voting Assistance Program. And in that, he compliments Oregon for providing electronic transmission for registration and ballot request and electronic transmission of the ballot. However, he encourages expanded use of the alternate to include acceptance of the voted ballot from the voter by electronic transmission where circumstances would otherwise disenfranchise a citizen. Colleagues and committee members, I ask you to support this bill. And again, my bill doesn't tell them how to do it. It doesn't address the Social Security numbers, the security. It just says, Secretary of State, this is something that needs to be done. It's being done in other states, and please implement this policy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this witness? Next, we'll have Georgette Brown from the Associated County Clerks and Dave Franks from the Secretary of State's office.
I think Dave Franks should start.
Okay, that would be great.
Thank you, Georgette. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Franks. I'm the Help of America Vote Act and Centralized Voter Registration Manager for the Secretary of State's office. Thank you for letting me come before you today. I provided a handout for you that I think is very timely. That hopefully you all have. It's a report from the Pew Center on the States, from the Pew Charitable Trust. They do a lot of work in the area of elections. It's titled No Time to Vote, Challenges Facing America's Overseas Military Voters and Other Overseas Voters. The report identified 25 states along with the District of Columbia that have identified problems with receiving and being able to make sure that their overseas voters have enough time to get their ballots back. The good news is Oregon was not one of the 25 states listed. Appendix B of the report has a series of recommendations for those states needing improvement. You'll find that Oregon already complies with the vast majority of those recommendations. Vote by mail already allows us to meet a lot of these requirements. We require the counties to send their military and overseas ballots out 45 days in advance of the election. This meets the standard set by the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. That is the report, Chair. I'm sorry. Okay. Oregon also accepts the federal write-in absentee ballot. An overseas voter can get this from a number of government and nonprofit websites. Use that to write in their choices for the votes and send it back to Oregon, and it's accepted by all of Oregon's counties. Counties are already able to email or fax copies of ballots in an electronic format or use the alternate format ballot, which we've developed for use by voters with disabilities. And it's electronic format of the ballot. And I believe the bill mentions the U.S. Department of Defense program, which also basically does the same thing, allows voter information and ballot information to be sent to the voter electronically or via fax machine. It does not have a mechanism at this time, in my understanding, to return ballots electronically. So there's still some gaps in that federal system. Oregon also participated in the Federal Express program. Federal Express Worldwide offered any overseas voter an opportunity to overnight their ballot back to Oregon or other states at a greatly reduced rate. All they had to do was get it to a FedEx office somewhere overseas.
and we participated in that program.
And I have some numbers for you.
In the 2008 general election, our registration system showed that we had 17,452 voters identified as military or overseas, and that was by their address type. Of those, we received ballots from 13,021, or 75% response rate for our military and overseas voters. That is a little bit less than our local voters. We were about 85%, I think, turnout for the general election. But I think you'll find that it was much better than the participation from overseas voters in other states. We are interested in some of the opportunities presented by this bill. We do have some concerns because it does just tell us how to do it, not how to do it. It seems to lead us down the road of possibly internet voting. And as you all know, there's a lot of concerns with internet transactions and security around that. So there's a lot of things that would have to be addressed there and would probably incur some pretty substantial costs. At this time, there's no federally certified internet or electronic transmission-based system available for us to go out and buy. So would it be have something that we have to develop from scratch? And also then raises the question of, is this a system that would have to require federal certification by the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission? There's a good chance of that. The Help America Vote Act put the EAC in charge of certifying voting systems in 2002, and right now it takes them about 2 years to get a system through their certification process. The cost for such a system, as I mentioned, would be hard for us to estimate because we really don't have the specifics of it at this time. That doesn't mean there aren't other things that we think we can look at. We continue to work with the federal and local jurisdictions to explore effective and efficient options for meeting the needs of these and all eligible voters. And there are some low-tech options that we think may be possibilities. Many counties in California experimented with having ballots faxed back. There are some security issues associated with that as well, but we think that's a low-tech, low-cost option that would require some change in our statutes and our rules, but would allow for a quicker transmission back of ballot information. So with that, I guess I'll conclude and turn it over to Georgia.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Georgette Brown, Josephine County Clerk. I represent the Oregon County Clerks Association. It's hard for me to get away from that. Okay, what I want to talk about are just some of our concerns. I'm not against doing electronic voting eventually, but we do have some concerns. Security is the main one. Knowing that the right person to whom the ballot is sent receives it and that in some way the signature of the voter can be verified. And how could paper recounts be conducted according to Oregon requirements? The technical challenges, according to computer technology statement on internet voting, that's what's being passed around, but I'm just going to summarize some of that for you. And that was September 2008. The voting system as a whole must be verifiably accurate in spite of the fact that the client systems cannot be guaranteed. Must be free of malicious logic. Software firmware or hardware could change, fabricate or delete votes, deceive the user in myriad ways, including modifying the ballot presentation, leak information about votes to enable voter coercion or perform online electioneering. There must be a satisfactory way to prevent large-scale or selective disruption of vote transmission over the Internet. There must be strong mechanisms to prevent undetected changes to votes. There must be reliable, unchangeable, voter-verified records of votes that are at least as effective for auditing as paper ballots without compromising ballot secrecy. The entire system must be reliable and verifiable. Even though internet-based attacks can be mounted by anyone, anywhere in the world, potential attackers could include individual hackers, political parties, international criminal organizations, hostile foreign governments, or even terrorists.
We are told that the current internet architecture makes such attacks difficult or impossible to trace back to their sources. Given the list of potential problems, there's reason to be skeptical of internet voting proposals. Therefore, the principles of operation of any internet voting system should be publicly disclosed in sufficient detail so that anyone with the necessary qualifications and skills can verify that election results from that system can reasonably be trusted. The internet has the potential to transform democracy in many ways, but permitting it to be used for public elections without assurance that the results are verifiably accurate is an extraordinary and unnecessary risk to democracy. A pilot internet voting project conducted in 2000 to encourage voter participation by Americans abroad cost the Pentagon $6.2 million. And received high marks from its director, although it delivered only 84 out of a potential 250 votes in the November election, and failed to address a key security concern, according to the Center for Public Integrity. In July of the following year, the National Commission on Federal Election Reform, led by former Presidents Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, released its final report on issues related to improving the process and administration of federal elections. The report argued against voting over the Internet, citing technical and security dangers. David Cook, Director of Administration and Management in the Office of Secretary of Defense, told the House Armed Services Committee in May that that the Internet should be reserved for registration and not voting. He stated that although our pilot project demonstrated that remote registration and voting over the Internet is a secure, viable alternative in a small-scale, tightly controlled environment, there are a number of security concerns in expanding to a larger population at this time. And then the Department of Defense in 2007 issued this regarding electronic voting plans for 2008 and 2010. It said the required guidelines on electronic voting from the EAC and NIST, EAC is the Election Administration Council, and NIST is the Secretary of State, the National Secretary of State, will frame strategies for the eventual development of a large-scale internet voting project. The guidelines have not yet been released, and this anticipated project is several years from inception. In the meantime, the Federal Voters Assistance Program will continue to provide voter registration, ballot requests, and ballot transmission strategies that are alternatives to the by-mail process for the overseas voters during 2008 and 2010 election cycles. The department will not offer any tools that allow for voters to cast voted ballots over the Internet. The January 1, 2010 effective date described in House Bill 2511 could very well be too soon for addressing all of the security concerns.
The registration bill is effective 2011, so that's even after this one would be effective. So I really feel it's a little bit too early to mandate
such a thing.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Representative Burke.
I haven't read the bill, and you may be right about some of the mandate issues, but I will say that Mr. Franks, in your document that you gave out, this No Time to Vote, on page 25, it says, Federal Voting Assistance Program encourages all states to move to a fully electronic election process. I don't know how that could be more clear. and it does have a discussion in here that I was reading during your testimony that there are some issues. So I guess between chickens and eggs and carts and horses, I think that this bill speaks to the fact that we better start addressing this issue and we better start addressing it promptly, and that there are other states that are moving in this direction. And I think that the model for why we should be doing it are these overseas voters who are serving in our military. So I'm not disputing, you know, the difficulties, but clearly we're not the only ones, and we ought to be moving this way. It says so in your book.
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, and members of the committee, when this document talks about electronic transmission of election materials, including ballots, most of the time they're referring to allowing a ballot to come back via email rather than an internet-created or based whole new voting system. There are still a number of security concerns with that, but there are, I think, about 9 states that are looking at doing that or starting to do that, and most of them also include fax-back ballots as well.
Yeah, I can, Chairman Roblin and Representative, I can assure you that in the election offices we do our very, very best to get the ballots to the military, people, and we do get most of them back from them. We haven't had complaints from them in our offices, really.
From the way I read the bill, an email system where you can email it out and then scan something and email it back would probably be within the limits of this bill, as I read it. I mean, it doesn't say it has to be electronic in other ways. I mean, so because it is fairly open-ended, that could be an option, correct? Do you see that same way?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, yeah, I think I do. We would probably like a little more specificity in the bill to help define that for sure, because it is pretty broad right now, and it may fall into that definition of a new, you know, voting system, which then leads us into some federal requirements as well as some other state requirements. But I think there are options that we can look at for, again, fax or email-based transmission. Email, as it comes in from a number of locations around the world, though, does have the ability to be manipulated and hacked as well, and so I think all of our local election officials would have some concerns with that.
And that's why the date of 2010 is really early for that, since we're 2009 now.
Right. Thank you both. So we have another hearing in another committee that starts right at 5 o'clock, so we need to get out. So we have about 10 minutes. We have 4 people who are on our list, so I'm going to time limit people to about 2 minutes each, and if they want to get some more, they can. This bill is just going to have the hearing today. We'll do some more after that. So Ruth and Sharon, you want to come on up? And if you can keep it to about 2 minutes each, that would be great right now, and then we'll come back and do some more later.
Chairman, my name is Ruth Bendel. I'm the Integrity Chair for the Republican Party, and I'm urging a no vote on electronic voting at this period of time. Our inept voter registration policies have already had a major role in an immigration fraud that was uncovered in 2003. Our adversaries certainly are well aware of the loopholes in our system. And I would go so far as to say that we have been investigating the number of deceased voters that are on the electoral roll, but more importantly, the number of deceased voters that have managed to get a vote cast on their behalf. And at this moment, we've been just going through a few hundred that were active voters, deceased several years ago, and we are over 40 that have already been confirmed. But one of the things that we learned when we were having those confirmed was that from the website you can actually get these people's social security number. So if you are relying on social security numbers being accurate, I can assure you that there are well-financed organizations that can look up those records, look up obituaries, and look up election rolls, and can certainly utilize that information to register to vote, update a registration, and certainly to utilize that vote. And complaints have gone into the Secretary of State already on 16 of these deceased people, but I want to apply that situation to electronic registration and electronic voting. The information is out there on websites. You don't have to pay an awful lot of money for it. And there are certainly organizations out there, I'm not going to name names, that are being thoroughly investigated. And until you have gotten situation where a person cannot access somebody else's voting data, forget electronic voting. And certainly when people, we've got thousands of inactive registrants on our voter rolls at the moment. All it takes to update that registration is for somebody to just fill out a registration and refer to the data that's already in the system, and no ID required. Let's clean it up.
Chair, my name is Sharon Cornish. I back Ruth up because I've also given many years as an observer. We're not here to be negative against your employees, but we know the money came with HAVA. We know that it is not transparent, and we know it could be cleaned up. We need these election rolls cleaned up. And the death certificates are supposed to come down here to the state, and then the state is supposed to inform the locals to clean it up. We're cleaning it up. How come?
Yeah.
How come? You can election people up here from the Secretary of State, and everything's fine. Well, it isn't fine. It isn't fine. Please listen to us.
Thank you.
I want to refer you to ORS 247570, Notice of Death to Secretary of State and County Clerks, and it's on page 21 of your election law book, has been there since 2003, so please tell me why we've got 6,200 deceased voters on the electoral roll, 1,200 of them listed as active, so that anybody else could just get in and utilize their ballot. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Next we have Norman Terrell, League of Women Voters, and Janice Thompson, Democracy Oregon. And again, it looks like about 2 minutes.
Go first,
if you can.
So Janice Thompson, Democracy for Oregon, neutral on 2511, though in wholehearted support of the kind, I think what I see as being the underlying goals of, like, obviously ensuring effective voting by overseas military and opening up new options. Neutral because of concerns somewhat about, some of it is semantics, and it's like, online. I mean, I actually love all the Pew Charitable Trust reports, read that report thoroughly, and I think, you know, like the reference you made to, I think, is more to, like, transmittal in electron. I mean, so I think there's a semantics problem coming up here, as well as the quick timeline on the bill. But overall, it was great to see, you know, Oregon not to be identified as having, like, problems. Improvements are always possible, and I think we have a very receptive Secretary of State and Elections Division on this regard. And, you know, as the first step solution, particularly on the timeline and the bill, though, online voting seems a little premature, you know, reviewing of lower-tech options and obviously working out all the security concerns. So wholeheartedly in support of, like, the concepts and just not quite sure this is the right vehicle on the right timing.
Thank you very much.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm here representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I probably for the record should point out I'm also a member of the National Board of the League of Women Voters of the United States. Probably more relevant for today's discussion, I'm also by profession a software engineer. I also co-chaired and co-authored a report by the National League on election audits, which I'd be happy to provide to you and has some relevance to this because online voter registration, voting, as far as I've seen so far, cannot be audited or verified. And until it can, really, it would not meet the League's criteria. And so the League wants to say that we're not for or against this bill. We are very ambivalent, in fact, about it, that we really want to encourage everybody possible to vote in the world, but we can't see that this particular vehicle is verifiable and auditable. I also want to make a connection to the fact that this is also about overseas voters. It's not just about military voters. And secondly, that there may be a connection to lower tax solutions. For example, voters with disability now have a system where they can call into the Secretary of State's offices and vote by phone. And that might be a way of solving the same kind of problem. And that is at least verifiable because they have to sign up ahead of time to do that, and they're called back before they can actually go ahead and vote, as I understand how it works. So I wanted to echo what the clerk said to you about their concerns, and I'll stop.
Any questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much. Just and also for the record, we did receive four pieces that should have been in your handouts from other people. One, Kathy Jackson, submitted on the 24th for House Bill 2511, and then a couple others, and with it a bunch of other materials for that. So you should have four separate pieces in it for the record. I will close our public hearing on House Bill 2511. And any?
I was just going to say, I think we can do this quickly if you want.
We don't have the physical, so we can put the amendment in. I guess what I would ask people to do on 2440, that we got the information in the amendment. We don't have the physical, so we will be planning to put that together at one time, and if you have any concerns about that bill, please let me know. I feel like it's different. Oh, it's different. Oh, that's right. One, two, three, four, five. There's five of us. We have one more. I have to do, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2440. This is just kind of a fun learning experience. 2440 was sent to us, and subsequently it was looked at and decided that since it deals specifically with the legislative branch by itself, that we should send it to Legislative Administration Committee. So we're going to do what we usually call tap-tap, where we send bills off to other places. So
pass that to your vice chair.
I'll have my vice chair make a motion.
Mr. Chair,
do you need to open a work session? You did.
We open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2440 without recommendation as to passage be referred to House Administration Committee and with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
So Representative Edwards has moved House Bill 2440 without recommendation as to passage to be referred to the House Administration Committee and with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Representative Berger.
Question, Mr.
Chair.
One of the drawbacks of electronic system is that when your computer runs out of batteries, you can't read the bill. And that happens to be my problem. And so my question is, I don't know who the sponsors of this legislation are. I'm wondering if they have been notified of this move or.
I think I've been working with them. I doubt that they have been notified specifically, but I will take care of that because I think.
Okay, thank you. I would like to bring that forward for the record that whoever they are.
There are a lot of them. But Representative Thatcher, if she were here still, yes, I could have told her.
Yeah, in fact, I'm one of the sponsors.
Yes, you are. But it has to do with legislative auditing and the whole idea of having a legislative audit division as opposed to just the Secretary of State's auditing. And when you look at legislative administration and who's there, we really felt that was probably as good a place as any to have that conversation.
Being Mr. Chair, as one of the sponsors, I would have liked to have had it in this committee, but I will support the motion.
So, any other discussion? Hang on. All those in favor? No. Is there any disagreement? Seeing none, so ordered. Thank you very much. And now we'll close the work session on 2440. Thank you for reminding me, our administrator. And now the other bill that we heard on the electronic
2386.
Look over the amendments. Make sure if you have any understandings, let get a hold and we'll do that at another time. So with that, we will close our Rules Committee. Thank you very much. We made it just in time.
Does anybody here have a key to the lounge that would let me in?
I do.
Would you let me in?
Sure. I do.